This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Ruttinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Well, Jay, a lot of interesting things happened this week, actually. For a post-election week, it was kind of an interesting series of events. We've got leadership fights all up and down the country, as well as here in Texas. Let's start with some news about one of our Supreme Court justices, 85-year-old Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the notorious RBG.
That's right. The notorious one herself got into a little accident. You would have thought they'd bubble wrapped her, that they don't let her leave the house without like a flak jacket.
All right.
But she apparently had an accident, ended up breaking a couple of ribs. But in true notorious RBG fashion, was back at work within like 2 days.
Wow.
You got an 85-year-old Supreme Court justice that can probably, you know, do more push-ups than either you or I.
Right.
Breaks ribs, gets back to work, and we got a president who's afraid of the rain.
Right. I read a report that said that she plans to resume her workouts next week, which is sad because, like, I haven't worked out for, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks. So she breaks ribs and is back at it right away.
And her workouts are apparently, like, crazy. I don't know if you've seen it. They're all over the internet.
Right.
She is a warrior, so it'll be interesting to see. And she's got a movie coming out soon, apparently. So
she's doing well, right? No flies on her. Let's talk about the House leadership fight. So we'll talk more about the leadership fight in Texas because that apparently has been settled. But it is not settled at the U.S. House level. Actually, we have what might be a pretty serious fight here in the Democratic caucus for who's going to be Speaker of the House.
Well, you know, it's interesting, right? The Democratic Party is essentially built around young people, minorities, and women. And the leadership, particularly one that they currently have, is about the average age is about 187 years old. So
right.
Years young. So the big rub has been that the chronological age of Nancy Pelosi, who is the current House leader on the Democratic side and presumed Speaker, Steny Hoyer, the majority leader, are both been there a very long time, and they are both in terms of duration in the House and also they're just old,
yeah.
Both over 75 years old. And so part of the issue ends up being, should you have more youth and inject something into the leadership?
Well, yeah, and this is what Martha Fudge, who is a Democrat from Ohio, has basically said, that the Democrats voted for change, right? That's her read on the election. She's an African-American woman, and her claim is basically that the Democrats don't have anybody who is of diverse in the leadership, and this is something which the Democrats talk all about, but that they never act on. So the case here is pretty interesting. Obviously, the Democrats are bound by caucus rules to vote for whoever wins the nomination for Speaker. That's basically an internal majority vote that's usually secret. The people who are against Pelosi say they've got votes, essentially, to keep Pelosi from being Speaker. So that's pretty interesting. But like you say, I mean, she's been Speaker before. She's been a leader since 2003. She's a lightning rod, Jay, for the kind of political vitriol that is, I think, really potentially hurting Democrats down ballot. So people are looking for a progressive change, and maybe they're going to find it. But actually, let's talk about the Republicans, too, because they just had a leadership fight where Kevin McCarthy from California beat his long nemesis, Jim Jordan, who is a member of the Freedom Caucus. So what's your take on what's happening in the Republican side?
You know, that's one of those situations where Kevin McCarthy, ironically, Kevin McCarthy was a freshman when Nancy Pelosi was last the Speaker of the House. So that gives you sort of a bit of a contrast.
Wow.
McCarthy is a longtime friend of Donald Trump and a favorite. He is an interesting guy, sort of. He comes from a more moderate district, but has always had support among conservatives. He's not a Freedom Caucus guy. So it's an interesting kind of move. You know, with the kind of turnover they've had in terms of the losses they've had, you would have expected the Republicans to, I think, kind of clean house. They kind of went the opposite direction, sort of doubled down with stability. As you might remember, this was the job no one wanted. They basically had to beg Paul Ryan to be the Speaker last time.
Right.
So not too unexpected.
Not a great job, right?
Yeah, apparently a job nobody wants.
I think our listeners would be surprised to learn that Kevin McCarthy, a Republican from California, is a Republican from California. He's one of the few left.
Exactly. It's like the dodo bird. You know, it's there. They're barely on life support, potentially extinct.
That's right. Yeah. Well, the Freedom Caucus actually has fallen on hard times. Jim Jordan, who was sort of the anchor of much of that, is obviously lost here. But I think how the Republicans treat him and the Freedom Caucus going forward is going to tell us a lot about kind of where ideologically the Republicans will be and exactly what their tactic will be to try to combat whatever it is that the Democrats are doing. Well, hey, speaking of combat, we have a little press versus White House round 6 million going on. Jay, what is happening with this lawsuit?
Well, CNN decided to sue the White House to reinstate the press credentials of its White House reporter, Jim Acosta. That suit has now been joined by really a large number of news agencies that cover the White House. But one notable addition to that recently was Fox News, which is a longtime friend, I guess, if you want to use that term, of the White House.
Ally.
Right, ally. Let's use ally of the White House. And so essentially you've got a unified press corps that's essentially saying, look, we will cover the White House. We will treat you with respect, but you can't dictate to us who gets to cover the White House. And there's sort of fundamental questions of freedom of the press. The president himself has essentially tweeted out, making the suggestion that he can ban anyone's credentials.
Right. It's my house. I'm not letting you in. Well, yes, the White House has maintained essentially that they have broad discretion to regulate press access. That's historically been true, but we've never had this level of, you know, vitriol before. So I think we're in uncharted territory. The courts are going to have to potentially sort this out. I was surprised, actually, that this was a case that moved anywhere as opposed to just being a threat. The courts have a history of defending access for journalists, so I am not sure that the White House is going to win on this, but I'm really curious to see kind of how it is exactly that they justify that decision.
Yeah, I think that the press corps is going to win on this as well. I'm not sure there's any chance for the White House, but they just want to drag this thing out.
Yeah.
And it probably takes away from some of the other, you know, not enjoyable things that are going on in the White House right now. Big shock, there is more chaos.
What?
Or no chaos, depending on your perspective.
Right.
More White House turnover on the horizon, this time led by the First Lady of the United States. Brandon,
wow.
What's going on?
Yes, I'm going to say that this is definitely shade thrown. So the First Lady has had a little bit of a dust-up with Deputy National Security Advisor Maiva Ricardo, and essentially it comes down to seats on a flight. Apparently what had happened was that there were a larger than usual number of security individuals on a particular flight, and the deputy national security advisor, who has now been fired, was not happy about it. She threatened to revoke national security resources associated with the trip, which would have meant that essentially then the First Lady would have no policy staff. This reminds me of the events where Nancy Reagan was using astrology to try to determine when the president or her should travel. It's not quite that bad, I think, because there Nancy Reagan had legitimate concerns since there was an attempt on the president's life. But it's remarkable that the First Lady would execute her authority on this particular matter. And so I frankly like it. There apparently was some friction between this woman and the White House more broadly. So it seems like maybe it was time to part ways. But the fact that it happened with the First Lady at the start of it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, the fact that they're tweeting out, you know, that she showed no respect to her and the White House. And I mean, it's a little bit, I think, unseemly for the White House to be doing this in general, but it's certainly not to have the First Lady doing it.
Right.
You know what else is unseemly, Brandon?
Yeah.
The fact that the state of Florida doesn't know how to run an election.
Right.
They have become the punchline that just won't stop. Once again, the state of Florida is in the midst of a massive recount. They've got three heavily contested races, one for United States Senate, dealing with the incumbent United States Senator Bill Nelson and his challenger, Governor Rick Scott, a race for governor between Andrew Gillum, who is the mayor of Tampa, and Congressman Ron DeSantis. And they've got an agriculture commissioner race. And I'm going to tell you right now, I don't know who either of them are. But it just goes to show you that even there, they can't even get their little local ones fixed out. You've got machine recounts. You've got legal fights. This is kind of Bush v. Gore-esque. We don't know if we have hanging chads yet. Because they apparently have machines that can only be run literally hand-fed one at a time.
That's great.
Crazy time in Florida,
right.
Not too much of a surprise.
Hey, you know what? Let's break out the Chumbawamba. It's 2000 all over again, Jay, right? It feels like just all everything that's old is new again.
I know. I get knocked down, I get up again.
We'll see if they do. The federal district court in Tallahassee may have something to say about, though, Jay. They have said here essentially that the counties need to be in a position where they're able to count about 4,000 rejected ballots The judge implies there's sufficient time to make this happen. He has suggested the state law is unconstitutional because essentially ballots can be rejected with, quote, no standards and essentially no real process. So these races, like you say, are really close. I mean, they're between 10,000 and 30,000. So 4,000 ballots here is not going to be like the difference maker. But if this happens in other places around the state, you're definitely going to see some things moving. But I think, again, we've talked about this a couple different times, the fact that this is not sorted out after the debacle of the 2000 election and after hundreds of millions of dollars spent on the reinvestment in infrastructure for voting is really outstanding. So again, this is going to be, I think, where many of the civil rights fights are going to happen, and we need to pay more attention to election administration.
You know, are you familiar with Barney, the giant purple dinosaur?
I am.
He sings a great song of all the raindrops were lemon drops and gumdrops. I think that's exactly what the president was hoping for, because apparently regular H2O water scares the bejesus out of the leader of the free world.
Right. Yeah. You know, Jay, for me, I agree. Rainy days and Mondays always get me down. Yes, apparently the president had decided that he wouldn't attend a wreath-laying ceremony in Paris in honor of World War I veterans, in part because there was rain. Now, it's not totally the president's fault. The president said that the deputy White House chief of staff said that there were concerns about flying Marine One through the rain and fog from Paris to the cemetery, which was about 50 miles away. So, again, it's a staffing problem. Donald Trump threw this deputy White House chief of staff under the bus immediately, or maybe under the helicopter immediately, and said that this was their fault and that he wanted to go, but they wouldn't let him. So, again, it's this internal fight and this friction, which is potentially reaching the chief of staff, even himself, right? There's some conversation that maybe John Kelly will get the axe during this interim period.
I'm going to break a theory right now. Okay. I'm going to get all tinfoil conspiratorial here.
Okay.
I've never seen Donald Trump's hair wet.
Whoa.
And I'm telling you right now, he can't wear a MAGA hat at a memorial service. So as a consequence, he didn't want to get his hair wet.
That is a good
so you
point.
Had... You had a memorial service where you had the leadership of the entire free world, except for Donald Trump, and so it's an embarrassing situation, and he's being epically trolled by the French of all people, and now the president sort of pushed back, and I think did some pretty silly tweeting on the day of their memorial service for 130 people who died in a terrorist attack. It's just looking bad, and it is essentially destroyed a relationship that he had with French President Emmanuel Macron, which was actually a good one.
Yeah. Well, let's shift gears and talk about Texas. The State Board of Education, as all of our enlightened listeners know, is the board which is essentially in charge of determining what the standards are for our youngest public school attendees. So they had made some controversial decisions, and of course have done in the past. What are some of the things that highlighted the most recent meeting, Jay?
Well, there's a lot of things, right? So there were initial recommendations that were made to include the Ten Commandments as part of the tradition for the founding fathers, even though there was actually no presented evidence to that effect. There were initial recommendations to remove Hillary Clinton and Helen Keller as historical figures. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, all of that looks like it's being, with the exception of Moses, is still apparently a founding father of our Declaration of Independence. but Hillary Clinton and Helen Keller are back in the mix, so we'll have at least a little bit of a curriculum. And look, the State Board of Education has been the butt of jokes globally, and there's probably a group of people less qualified to make decisions about what should and shouldn't be included in academic publications. You and I deal a bit in the textbook world. Mm-hmm. Having these folks dictate who should be studied and who should not is probably a bit of a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, the board, as you say, refused to modify the controversial lessons about the causes of the Civil War. And like you said, they kept Moses as an influence on the nation's founding fathers. So obviously, these are going to be political choices because there's a lot of controversy no matter how you choose to include or exclude. So it's a tough job, but I'd like to see the temperature politically reduce on this a little bit. Now, there was a time where that was happening. It feels like we're in a bit of a holding pattern, but this is going to be a fight that's going to continue. Hey, speaking of continuing, we have some news that Justice Phil Johnson has announced that he's going to retire at the end of the year. Greg Abbott is, of course, in position to appoint a successor. So what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, I think it's a good thing for certainly for the governor. Justice Johnson is retiring about 2 years early from his term. He would be up in 2020. It removes one contested race immediately off because you're going to get an appointment. He's going to give that person an opportunity to essentially, I think, create at least a modified legacy on whether or not they're going to be able, assuming they're going to want to run for re-election. Mm-hmm. And so it gives that person a running start. And I assume that's his intention because he himself had no interest in running for re-election. Yeah. So it's probably a good thing. We saw in the aftermath of the elections, the Democrats essentially did extremely well, not just at the local level, but the appellate court level. The last sort of bastion for Republicans in the court system has been at the Criminal Court of Appeals and the Texas Supreme Court. Those are solidly Republican, entirely Republican. That might change in 20 and then in 22. So this is probably an attempt to try to mitigate some of that.
You know, what's interesting is that the first set of dominoes to fall for Republicans when they began to kind of chip away at the Democrats' margin in the state was that they were winning Supreme Court seats. And oddly enough, these are the last to hold on. So that's interesting to see. I think you're exactly right. I think that Governor Abbott here has got a tremendous opportunity. And this is an opportunity that all governors have, especially if they serve long enough, to leave a serious mark on the state. And I think the governor's going to do that. I guess the only good news for the governor is that there are a lot of people to choose from, right? So as you noted, there are a bunch of individuals who have lost their seat as a result of the sweep in Dallas County and in Harris County. So individuals like Jane Bland or Mike Massengale, who have, you know, served for a while in these courts, may be in a position that they are going to get an appointment, if not here, maybe in some other capacity. So there is a tremendous opportunity here. And I think we need to look to the courts to be able to think about what's going to happen next politically. Well, speaking of what's going on politically next, we've got an announcement from John Cornyn, who confirms he's seeking re-election in 2020.
Yes, this comes as no great surprise. You had everyone from Mimi Schwartz in the New York Times basically writing a column saying that he was gone. He had actually announced that he was going to lose or not run for re-election.
Okay.
I think she had said he was not going to run for re-election. He had actually announced back in 17 that he was going to run for re-election. Hmm. And obviously the speculation now is, is he going to run for re-election? Because now Texas looks far more competitive. There's the question of whether or not Beto O'Rourke makes a run in 24 U.S. Senate if he's not too busy running for president. So all of this comes into play. It'll be interesting to see what happens to Cornyn, largely because there was a legitimate threat he was going to be primaried, and that was one of the reasons why he wasn't inclined to run. I don't know if the results this cycle is going to make the Republican primary electorate sort of shift more to the center or sort of double down. Mm-hmm. If they double down, John Cornyn is the least popular statewide Republican among traditional primary electorate.
Yeah.
So if he stays and he has a tough primary battle, we'll see what happens. If it's open and he decides at the last minute to keep it open, and we've talked about this last week, George P. Bush is the obvious guy who could win that seat.
Yeah, that's right. Well, he has two challengers already. Cleveland business owner Dwayne Stovall, who ran against him in 2014 but only got 11% of the vote, has announced, as well as Sema Hernandez. Remember, Sema Hernandez got 24% in the Democratic primary against Beto O'Rourke, partly because she won the Valley in big numbers. So it's not like, I think so far we've got A-listers coming after Cornyn, in part because he doesn't have the same negatives that Cruz had. I think part of the reason why, and we talked about this, 18 was so close for the U.S. Senate race, was that Cruz was uniquely vulnerable, and Cornyn isn't that vulnerable in the same way.
I will just say, because I've had that argument before with people, if you look at the polling, John Cornyn is less popular than Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz also has the advantage of having a Spanish surname.
But among Republicans, though.
Among Republicans, but that still counts for something.
Yeah. No, it does, and there's a chance that he could get a primary, but I don't think anyone's going to primary John Cornyn, right? I mean, I can't imagine the kind of Republican who would decide that this is like a good career move long-term,
have you not
right?
met the lieutenant governor of the state of Texas?
There's no way that's going to happen, right? There's no way. Besides, being lieutenant governor is way better than being in the U.S. Senate, right? Anyway, some interesting news in the rest of the state, Jay. The Trump administration has actually moved to bar asylum for immigrants who enter the country between ports of entry. There are some implications here to immigrants who are attempting to cross the border, Jay. What do you think is going on?
Well, so as we know, the largest land border in the United States is between Texas and Mexico along the Rio Grande, there are only a specific number of ports of entry that exist along that border. So any entry made outside of those three or four ports of entry would be an illegal entry. So that would mean that you're barring potentially thousands of people who illegally cross trying to seek asylum.
Yeah.
As a practical matter, what would end up happening is you would see massive instability in places like Ciudad Juarez across from El Paso and McAllen and Brownsville down in South Texas. So it's going to create huge problems for Texas border communities. And so there's huge ramifications to this if it actually ends up happening.
Yeah, exactly. And a potential like refugee crisis, right? They're basically camping out at the border waiting to come in. This is where you need to have a good relationship between the governor and the president and the citizens and the leadership in Mexico. So we'll see if that happens. Obviously, it's been a kind of a slow build, so we'll hope to keep an eye on that, but we'll hope that things don't go badly.
Well, Brandon, we've got a race again. We just finished one, and we get to vote for a state
already.
Senator here, in, at least in the Houston area, Senator Sylvia Garcia, who was successfully elected to become a member of Congress for Congressional District 29, is now finally resigned her seat, or officially resigned her seat.
Or it's been accepted,
it's
I
been
guess.
It's been accepted, I guess.
Both,
and she
both.
Really had resigned a while ago, but that's another issue.
Right.
For Senate District 6 in the southeast quadrant of Harris County or in the Houston area. You've already got two announced very strong challengers in State Representative Carol Alvarado and State Representative Ana Hernandez. Really, it's going to be a kind of a knockdown dragout. It's going to be a quick race, December for the first go around.
Yeah.
And if you need a runoff, if there's more people coming in, it's going to be in January. But now we got a new senator on the horizon.
Interesting. Yeah, I think we'll see a couple more people jump in this race. But I don't see any way that anybody is going to be able to, you know, outraise or out-organize Carol Alvarado or Ana Hernandez at this point. Alvarado had almost 500,000 in the bank as of the end of October. Hernandez had a good chunk, about 200,000 in June. She didn't have a general election opponent, so she didn't file reports. But at that point, you have to give the edge to Alvarado.
Yeah, Alvarado had run before against Garcia,
right.
Was in a runoff,
right.
A very contentious runoff, did very well. She's most of her district, in fact, she has the largest percentage of SD6, is her state rep seat. Longtime state rep, very popular. I think the edge certainly goes to her.
Yeah.
But Ana Hernandez herself has a great story to tell, and I think it'll be an interesting race.
I think so, too. Yeah, in fact, Alvarado has been organizing as well as Hernandez. I'd give the edge here to Alvarado. She has Beto O'Rourke's Harris County campaign manager as her manager. So I think that just in terms of the kind of joltage, I think that's probably going to give her a bit of an edge. But like you say, it's going to be a really tough race and interesting to watch.
Well, we've got pre-filing happening in the Texas legislature, Brandon.
Right around the corner.
Well, you had people literally lining up. State Senator Judith Zaffarini is famous for this. She literally has her staff lined up there so when the doors open, she can put out first set of bills. We've already got bills for free tuition or subsidized tuition for students for community college and college. We've already got bills out there for changing the way we vote.
Yes.
We've got legalization or decriminalization of marijuana. Traditionally on pre-filing, about the first 35 numbers are reserved for the speaker and the lieutenant governor. They pick and choose who they want. So we already know, you know, tax bills and school finance bills and property taxes and some of these meaty issues that have to be passed. The budget, obviously, are early bill numbers. But some of these ones I think are going to be interesting.
I think so, too. Let's put in a plug here for our special episode, which is our legislative preview. So we'll talk more about this and other related issues. In terms of these bills, it's, you know, unlikely many of them are going to see the like bright lights of the chamber. Only like 40% are ever going to get any kind of hearing and 20% are ever going to get to the governor's desk. So a lot of these are going to fall by the wayside. But I think you identified a couple of interesting ones. But we're going to see some serious fight here over religious exemption bills, which are piling up in that number. And the Democrats are not backing down from things like raising the minimum wage and digital ID. So there has been, I think, a real push from both parties to try to get their issues out there. Of course, exactly how it all shakes out will be determined by, in part, the incoming Speaker of the Texas House, Dennis Bonin.
That's right, Brandon. The big story for us, of course, is that we have a new Texas Speaker. We know how pivotal being the Speaker of the Texas House is. It's the third most important position in state government. And Dennis Bonin from Angleton, 46 years old, longtime member of the House. He was elected in his 20s, mm-hmm. been there a long time. Dennis the Menace, as he is known by really no one except for the two of us.
We just coined that trademark.
We're going to make it popular. He is now Speaker Dennis the Menace. He's got a lot on his plate, but the way he did it to me, Brandon, I think is really interesting. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is the Republican that many Republicans have been waiting for. He's procedurally fair. He runs a clean process. He's ideologically conservative. The fact that you had 80 different members of the Republican Party sign on, this is a fairly unanimous choice across the party's divide that frankly needed it, right, given the contentious atmosphere we've seen the last couple of sessions.
Right, not to mention 30 Democrats joined in as well. So you had almost more than half the existing caucus on the Democratic side sign in. He's a longtime member of the sort of the greater Houston area delegation in Brazoria County. I think the interesting thing there is he's worked a lot with Democrats in the past, especially folks like Sinfonia Thompson. He's close to Sean Theory here in Houston, was one of the members. So he's used to being it's different. It's he, like Strauss, is not from a traditionally rural district. That is an energy district, Angleton is, where he represents kind of combination both rural and urban. Mm-hmm. So I think he adds something that's unique. I think it'll be interesting. He's not been a guy known to really care much about those red meat social issues. And so I think the direction he takes will be more business oriented. He was a huge proponent of the revamp on school finance and the idea of using sales tax versus property tax.
Yeah, and he said that the big issue for him is going to be public education. And when he says it, that's a fairly serious take. So I suspect that's going to be part of it. He's also been big on cutting the franchise tax. He led the coalition to allow that to happen. He also tried to propose a different way of changing the tax structure to lower sales tax instead of lowering property taxes, and got some fairly conservative Republicans on board with him. So he's shown to be a consensus builder. Michael Quinn Sullivan of Empower Texans even suggested maybe this is the right choice, even though they spent $100,000 to defeat him and to give money to his primary opponent, whose name was Damon Rambo. That is not a typo. His name was Damon Rambo. But to me, I want to ask you this. I think the Democrats missed an opportunity here. So basically, many of them waited and kept their powder dry to see whether or not the Republican coalition wouldn't sort of circle around a particular member. They ended up doing it much more quickly than any of us expected. And the Democrats then sort of missed their opportunity, basically, to set the speaker the way they did with Joe Strauss. So do you think they missed their chance, or is this going to be good for them?
Well, I think it'll be good for them only in the sense that I think Bonin is relatively fair. He's been known as being procedurally fair. The issue, I tend to agree with you on this sense, is they were always in a weaker position. As soon as Bonin got 80 Republican House members, that's a massive, that's essentially almost unanimous there, and got people to pull out. Democrats essentially had to hurry up and get in there. They weren't able to get concessions. I think what they probably should have done and didn't do is get earlier in the process and try to cut a deal with someone.
That's what I thought too.
And that was the mistake I thought they made. Bonin probably would at one time, because Bonin was one of the guys who didn't sign the pledge to have the Republican caucus dictate. And he clearly didn't give much credence to it, because during his press conference announcing essentially that he had won, He had there on the dais with him lots and lots of Democrats. He wanted to come in as a bipartisan speaker, not a speaker of the Republican caucus.
I don't think it's optimal for them, but I think the Democrats hate Patrick worse than they hate Bonin. I mean, Bonin has shown that he's willing to stand up to Dan Patrick and to the Senate. So he's described the House versus the Senate like twin brothers, like sometimes you love them, sometimes you don't. So he will be somebody who stands up for the House. And that's something, frankly, that I think all members are looking for, including Democrats.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that was a big selling point. You know, Bonin's got that bull reputation in the House, and I think they wanted someone that was going to take it to Dan Patrick and not in any way back down. And that to me, is a big part of what this was.
Yep.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer and dark horse candidate for speaker, Bernie Manous. Special kudos to our web and graphics team at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer and frontrunner for speaker, Todd Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Ruttinghouse. We'll see you next week.